Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Higgins, Art Papers Executive and Artistic Director. Art Papers expands the dialogue around contemporary art and culture by exploring the ways they affect and reflect human experience. You can find a rich archive of interviews, reviews, feature essays, artist projects, and more on artpapers.org. Welcome to this month's episode of Echoes, a monthly series where we spotlight our community of contributors, writers and artists who've been central to Art Papers' creative and rigorous coverage over the years. This month, we revisit a conversation between curators and Art Papers' contributing editors, T.K. Smith and Lauren Tate Baeza. They discuss their contributions to our Spring 2020 issue, Art of the New Civil Rights Era. They talk about framing that moment in the context of multi-generational activism and about how contemporary artists contribute to the discourse of racial justice. The works they're discussing are linked in the description, and there's also a link if you'd like to support the work of Art Papers by making a donation or purchasing from our shop.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is T.K. Smith, and I am a contributor at Art Papers, speaking to you now on the occasion of Art Papers Presents. It's an online conversation we'll be having in correlation with the spring issue of Art Papers, Art, the New Civil Rights Era. Thank you for joining us. I'm currently waiting for Lauren Tate Baeza to join me in conversation, another contributor who contributed the New Civil Rights Moment, a recap. Let's see. Thank you again for joining us. If I can tell you anything about myself, I am no longer a Tina Dunkley Fellow. I am now a matriculating grad student at the University of Delaware, as well as an independent curator, writer, and arts critic. And I am currently based in Philadelphia. And Lauren Tate Baeza will tell you all the wonderful things about herself. She's an amazing scholar, amazing independent curator, an Africanist. She is the head of curation at the National Center for Human and Civil Rights, and just an all-around amazing person. I'm so thankful to be able to speak with her today. If you haven't had the opportunity to, please go online and check out the spring issue of Art Papers. It is now fully available online for free. All of our contributions, the dossier, and the reviews are available. And also, if you could look out for our summer issue, which will be coming soon, called Living and Working, where a lot of discussions on living and working within our field will be discussed. And so, and here's Lauren, y'all. Good afternoon. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
How are you? I introduced myself already, so if you would be kind enough to introduce yourself.
Yes, I was watching, and I couldn't get my request to come up, so I saw your whole wonderful introduction, and thank you for all the flattering things you said about me. So I'm Lauren Tate Baeza. I'm a curator and an Africanist, and I am currently the Director of Exhibitions at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights. I was fortunate enough to be a part of this incredible issue of Art Papers, and I am excited to talk to TK about his incredible contribution to this issue. Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Thursday.
And we decided we would format this in a going back and forth, asking each other questions about individual contributions. If you want to jump right into it, I'm ready.
Yeah, okay. TK. your piece is sort of, it's two essays in one. That's how I experienced it. There's your critical commentary on public monuments and how they embody and perpetuate power and national political histories. Most explicitly, you point to Confederate monuments as symbols of ongoing white hegemony. But then there is also this personal narrative that's woven through the piece, wherein you recount stories about your experiences with protests and police in St. Louis. And in the more personal segments, you discuss the body as a political tool. You engage, for example, how it can be strategically used to convey humor or weaponized through posturing, and you discuss how simple choices, sagging your pants, growing your hair out, or dressing up, each have a correlation to your relative viability for survival, as you say. Beautifully said. Later in the piece, as you continue to recount some of the more personal stories, the reader experiences you using your body as a political object through the act of protesting. You block traffic with your body. You lay down in the street to simulate Michael Brown's death. You use your body also to demonstrate affection and support, holding hands with two people you love at a protest, for example. So in addition to images of monuments, you include photographs that you took of bodies, in particular how people are adorning themselves. There are photos of tattoos and so forth. And in the end, when you're discussing Kehinde Wiley's Rumors of War, you take a lot of time to talk about how the figure, the subject, is adorned, how their hair is styled, what they're wearing, and how their posture is displayed for that piece. So I have a two-part question, and I don't mind coming back to ask the second one again if you forget by the time we get there. But with all of that in mind, can you take a little time to talk more about your takes on both the power and the limitations of how we physically show up in the world, specifically with regard to personal adornment and the things we can control? And then my second question is, what is the connection that you're making between public monuments, the built environment, and the body? The viewer is sort of allowed to see you juxtapose these things and glean their own meaning from it, but what are you specifically, what are the lines you're specifically drawing? If you could answer those two.
Yeah. The juxtaposition was intended to... The juxtaposition was intended to connect these two things. So even though they seem starkly different, I think it's the same conversation. And what we're talking about is how my body, my individual body, is placed in an environment that is built and constructed in and around me, right? You know, and how I adorn my body, just as well as how we adorn those environments. Are expressions of ideas, memories, commemoration, X, Y, and Z. And so I think that it all begins with the body, and that is what we are most individually autonomous in controlling and politicizing. I can choose to use my body in particular ways. I can dress my body in particular ways to say particular things. I can assimilate. I can be marginal. I can marginalize myself, I can be oppositional, I can be controversial based on particular ways that I present myself within the society that we have collectively, more so in the hands of those of power, have built together. And so I think that what might seem a stark difference isn't that different. How we memorialize, I memorialize, especially when you think about the means to memorialize and people who don't have much of any material wealth, how they memorialize, and then how those with vast amounts of material wealth memorialize. They're not that different, even though some are more ephemeral and speak to the experiences of life. Give me the second part one more time.
That was the second part. I think for me, the first part was just, what are your takes on the power and the limitations of how we show up in the world? Like, what is the power that we have? Like, to what extent do we have autonomy still showing up in the world in this body? And then how are we limited in this body? Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think my response to that is going to be super specific because I exist within a black body. And because it's racialized, and you can tell that it's racialized to have brown skin and pinky hair, like my experience with how I present myself is hyper-aware, like that Du Bois double consciousness. I'm always constantly seeing myself, how I see myself, and that is contrasting with how I am perceiving the world perceiving me because of these particular things. And so every body has... if they were to claim that autonomy or take the time to be introspective about how they present themselves, are making
particular small and sometimes large choices for how they are going to participate or work against the society that they're in. And the limitations of that is that the body itself is ephemeral. You can only give so much of yourself before it starts getting destroyed or taken away. And so even though I want to be optimistic today and say that it's endless how you present yourself, how I speak to you, what language I speak to you in, how much of my accent I give you, how long I let my hair get, how scruffy I let my face get, all of these things are pushing against, pulling forward a particular political ideology, I guess, a form of assimilation. But it's a limit because I'm black, it can kill me. You know, if I'm walking down the street sagging my pants and looking threatening, somebody might shoot me. And, you know, 5 years ago, I might say, if I were being aggressive or if I was, you know, but no, we're at a point now where we all understand I could just literally be walking down the street and somebody might just shoot me because they don't feel safe because of the way that I carry myself. So that's how I would answer that one. I know that was long, but I have a question for you. And it comes from the title of your work that contrasts with the title of the issue. The issue is called Art in the New Civil Rights Era. And then your work, which really opens up the issue after the editor's note, uses the term moment instead of era, which I understand is completely a conscious choice. And the framing of this constant fight for equal citizenship in the U.S., for against injustice, for some kind of retribution, that distinctive temporal language, such as eras, times, moments, uprising, versus a constant fight, is really interesting to me. What do you mean, and why did you choose to use the term moment, and who most benefits from that, and who is victim to that kind of temporal language?
For me, I used the word moment instead of movement. I was using that really deliberately as a replacement for the word movement. I do this lecture that's called Art in the Age of Black Power. And when I do it, I'm really speaking about artistic productions from 1967 through the bombing of MOVE in the 80s. But I frame it at the very beginning of the lecture through giving it historical context. I generalize, four major movements, black social movements in America, and then I also sort of make my argument that we're still in the black power movement, and I base that on the demands. So the movements that I kind of walk people through when I teach this is abolitionist movement, anti-lynching movement, civil rights movement, and then the black power movement, and I stop there because, again, I feel like that's where we still are. It was responding to a failed war on poverty, Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty, blighted urban communities, and very explicitly responding to the over-policing of black communities and the observation that this was then funneling people into a judicial system that was going to be biased, was going to be likely to find them guilty, and then going to give them harsher punishments than non-black people for the exact same crime. And this is very detailed in all of the work that's written by most notably the Black Panther Party, but other organizations at the same time that were existing at the same time and in dialogue with the Black Panther Party. And it's the same list of demands all these years later. It started off being called the Black Power Movement. We may want to change that title as this becomes history and as time progresses. And maybe this will all be identified as one giant movement that is sort of responding to state violence. It appears to me, just my subjective opinion, that with every success, systemic white supremacy finds another workaround. So the abolitionist movement was successful, in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, we had this incredible little tiny brief moment of progress, especially considering that people were literally just enslaved during Reconstruction. And then there was a response to that, right? Rampant lynching start happening from the post-Civil War era to through ongoing, but it really in this dramatic, constant, frequent, arbitrary, terrorizing way through the 1920s or so. And then National Association for the Advancement of Colored People really sort of cuts its teeth as an anti-lynching organization and starts to build a nationwide conversation in response to this, as opposed to like localized small grassroots movements, which have been happening the whole time. And that changes everything forever, right, in terms of how we mobilize against these movements at a national scale and now at an international scale. And that's successful. We still have lynchings, but the lynching numbers go down substantially after their efforts. And then the civil rights movement is really looking at voting rights and desegregation. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 are successes. Things are integrated, and it's almost like the police, the state then is like, well, tell you what we're not going to do. We have to lynch you in our restaurants, and we can't keep you from your federal jobs, but we're going to keep you in your place, and we're going to over-police your communities, and we're going to find every little crime you're doing, and we're going to create crimes when they don't exist. and another type of terrorism to continue to keep the status quo, right, which is that we are under thumb and in order, and we are in certain communities, and we have certain outcomes that are more likely, and those outcomes keep us from power, and that we are disenfranchised through all of these different means. But by the time, you know, there's coordinated efforts around responding to this, we are, I think, in my opinion, fighting so many wars at that time that it just doesn't, and there's an extremely coordinated effort to disband, right, the Black Panther Party and the like. But there's this, there's all these layers, I won't take too much time, but there's all these layers, of course, with the proxy wars happening, and it just gets really complicated and broad. Soviet, U.S. geopolitical stuff is kind of layered on all of this more simple struggle for just to stop over-policing our communities. And so it's never really gets a thorough treatment. It's never really heard out, and there's no real reform at all of the levels that it needs to take place in order to see change. And it's the same call for action. And so when it came time to write my piece, the title of the paper had already been named, Art of the New Civil Rights Movement. And so I felt like I needed to frame what I thought was meant by that. And so this last moment or chapter in the larger book of this ask or this conversation Black movies trying to have with America is the most recent moment is what I titled it. And the recent moment I think speaks to Black Lives Matter, which of course the hashtag is birthed out of the Trayvon Martin trial and then the acquittal of George Zimmerman. It also, to me, this new era sort of speaks to social media, cell phones, the transmission of information at a volume we've never seen before. All of this content sharing has really changed what this book, this move, the broader movement looks like. And so I want to kind of take a moment to talk about that part of this broader movement. And so that puts us at the last 10 years. And that's how I frame it. But I very deliberately didn't say movement because I think the movement started in 1967.
Since this movement has progressed after so many decades, do you feel like there's any usefulness in framing it in a conversation of generation and generational interests if the interests are the same?
Can you say that one more time for me, TK? I'm sorry.
Sorry, no worries. Just out of what you said, because this particular movement has expanded over so many decades, do you feel like there's any usefulness or utility in framing it through an understanding of generations? You know, a lot of the time I'll hear people say, well, my generation was most interested in this, and my generation was most interested in this, and this is the way that we were able to mobilize and create change or push against. But if this particular moment with these particular aims has spanned so many decades, is that conversation even useful?
Yeah, I really like the idea of framing time in terms of like broad political, technological, and social phenomena. Like, the generation thing just seems too narrow for me, and it gets messy really quickly. It's like, what generation am I? I don't even know half the time if I'm a millennial or a Generation X. Like, I just think, what do we even, I like the idea of like the internet, right? The internet generation, quote unquote. Or, you know, even when I'm looking at history, looking at things like naval capacity and how that changes the world, or agriculture and surpluses and how that meant that, you know, you could now be in one place, and how did that change society and culture and our understanding of spirituality. Like, I just like looking at phenomena, and I think for my piece, talking about the moment of cell phone activism, if you will, or how that became a part of a broader activism that was already happening, and how it empowered it, and how sometimes it limited it. But that's a huge thing that happened, right? We can now see, which you kind of chat about a little in your piece, you could see if you needed it, right? If you're a non-black person who's never actually experienced hostility with the police, somebody could record it on their phone and transmit it to millions of people. And it was this evidence, widespread, that, you know, we'd never really had before. We had it, of course, with during the civil rights movement, when we had news media sort of intersect with this incredible time in history. And so we have all this documentation in print from that era as well, but it doesn't beat real-time cell phones. I mean, it's such another level that I just feel comfortable framing it in that. And whoever's participating at whatever age they are, or whatever, I don't know, experiences that they had, I feel like we're all in it together. Just to illuminate the point, my father is 78 years old. He was affiliated with SNCC. He was part of the Albany movement. I still feel like he's been a part of this moment. I wouldn't, like, say because of his age or because of his previous involvement in this pre-Black Power movement, even by my own framing, participation makes him of something different. Like, I think he's been very involved in this moment as well. So, does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Do you have another one for me?
Yes. Okay. So my next question for you, is in Beyond a Monumental Black Body, you discuss the power dynamics implied by the types of monuments built by the state. But you're sure to also include that these monuments are destroyed by the power of the state. So here you hint at how a lack of power is reinforced by the fact that it is even up to someone else. As in, you know, an external governing body, process, court systems, et cetera, to decide to provide Black people freedom and respect, which I thought was really, really powerful. It's like, well, if someone can just wake up in the morning and say, you're free now, are you really free? Because they can just take it back, right? I love that you took a moment to talk about that. Like, their decision-making is still reinforcing how powerless we are. Especially when their decision-making doesn't include us, right? There's no committee, or we're not in the room. What are your thoughts on going through a longer, more diplomatic process of getting monuments celebrating slavery and slave owners removed versus moments such as what we've seen recently with protesters toppling monuments of Christopher Columbus and Confederate leaders all over the nation, and in fact, you know, colonialists, enslavers, statues of those types of people are also being toppled in Europe. What is your take on taking matters into your own hands and expediting the process and just dealing with the consequences of that versus going through the process? Is it an either or? Should you do both? What are your thoughts on both those approaches?
It's hard to not, like, be like, oh, short answer, just burn everything down, you know, because, you know, we had this conversation about Toni Morrison and her talking in reference to the LA riots about the restraint that people had waiting for justice before they took to the streets. And part of one of the reasons why I'm so interested in the body and autonomy is because the reality of the difference between said monument being taken down and my, you know, viability for survival is that I can really just go get a hammer and I can take it down. You know, I love that phrase, the power of the people is stronger than the people in power. And people forget that because we have so much law and so much social rule and so many social niceties, and we're working against centuries of demonization of our very internal beings. You know, people assume that Black people are inherently violent, inherently lazy, not ready for citizenship in Reconstruction era. You know, like, what are we pushing against? We're pushing against reality and ideology. And so if you say, you know, should people really just be decapitating these statues? You know, no, you can make an appeal to your city council or your city board and ask them to please remove it because it's racist. And then you have to prove why it's racist. And then it becomes a conversation on why you as an individual deserve to be treated like an equal citizen, why you are offended. And then you have to get into the historical context of all these things. Or, you know, risking jail, you can go take it down. And the messages are just equally powerful, if not one more powerful than the other. When they threw that statue in the canal, look, the symbolism of that, you know, like, it's impactful in a way that is more impactful than that statue just standing there. And that's the combative powers of white supremacy. How many of us is it going to take for you to remove this one symbol? How many of us, how many people, in reality, it only takes one person with a hammer. And so I'm not saying we need to go tear down all these statues. I'm just saying there's a reality to this conversation. And then there is litigation. And there's a reality, trauma, pain, murder, suffering. And then there is litigation. And if to stop me from being murdered, killed, you know, traumatized, I have to do something. I think I need to go ahead and do that and not become a victim of that restraint or that resilience, that language we use to slow down natural reactions to things. So, yeah, burn it down, you know. They're statues, they're not people. One, if you really wanted it back, you can build it again. They're not that priceless. They are stone and metal, and it's the future now, plastic. Like, we're getting innovative. And let's talk about what could be put there instead. You know, we can construct just as well as we can deconstruct. That's also a part of the conversation. If that answered, if that answered it fully.
Thank you for that. Do you have a question for me, TK?
Yes, yes. I want to know a point of entry for you in your own personal social activist life. You know, I think about us, again, as autonomous individuals, learning of our world, learning of our society, learning our history, and feeling the oppressive pressures that are put on us constantly. And I think, what is the last straw and the haystack that push someone to action, to change, to get involved? And I'm curious what that is for you in your own personal life, seeing your career's trajectory.
Thank you for such a personal question. So I think I have to start first with being really forthcoming about how I grew up. I think I had a little bit of a head start. So my parents, my father in particular, were what I now understand to be pro-Black. But I didn't know that. I was just being raised. They steeped our lives in Black poetry, Black history, Black values of beauty, Black literature. I never had my hair relaxed. And they did it with little fanfare. It wasn't like discussed in our home, like, we are activists, we are, you know, Pan-Africanists. It didn't really come up. They were just busy raising me, steeped in an environment where I saw myself and felt like I belonged everywhere. in all my children's books were black, my dolls. I truly didn't understand that this was an exceptional way to grow up as a black person in America until I got a little older and really started to observe other black kids' bedrooms when I'd go over their house to play, that they had white dolls, that they had books with white characters in them. And I realized, you know, that they were, as a result, probably not of this alone, of course, but began othering themselves. As you talked about this Du Bois, in imagining what they look like through the lens of white people, in a way I never really learned to do. And so as I grew up and went out into the world, there were certain elements of standards based on proximity to whiteness that I had never internalized. I never had to unpack, and therefore I never had to unpack them. Like, I think we all have gone through that by the time we're a good bit in our adulthood, we've unpacked that and we've re-embraced our identity, whether we wanted to or not sometimes. But I never really had to go through that process because it was never upheld for me in the first place. So I mentioned my dad was a Pan-Africanist, or that we were Pan-Africanist as a family. So I grew up with this very diasporan sense of identity and a strong affinity for an imagined Africa. And I say imagined because I didn't go to Africa until I was 30. So it was like the place of home for me somehow in my mind, based on how I was raised and the kinds of things that were said in my household. I was also introduced to Caribbean leaders and philosophers like George Padmore, Marcus Garvey, really young, very, very young. And then on the American side, I read by force the autobiography of Malcolm X, I think for the first time I was like 7 or 8. I mean, again, but there was no conversation about like, we're going to war. It wasn't very political. It just was, I mean, it was. I realize that and appreciate that now, but it didn't feel like work. It was just how I was growing up. And so, yeah, this broad sort of Pan-Africanist way of seeing myself in the world is kind of how I came into the world. And so I want to take a minute to talk before I get into, like, when I separated from my families and really had my own political moment. I want to talk about the role of music because I think it's really important. It's been foundational to me. So I had this sort of groundwork, you know, of being raised in this particular way. I also had a mother who was very... she warned against groupthink all the time, and she had this real, she would always talk about how rules were relative and made to be broken. And they were just, again, they were very radical, but they were very, like, matter-of-fact about it. There was no real discussion about what we were responding to. So in that way, it wasn't political, if that makes sense. They were being, now I know, of course, and we've talked about it a lot, they were being very intentional in how they raised myself and my brothers. But they didn't make us feel like they were doing something, you know what I mean? Like, so anyway, the role of music. So my parents played a lot of, you know, Bob Marley and Sly and the Family Stone, and this type of music reinforced the ideas that I was introduced to my whole life. And then when I got older and got in my own music, Bad Brains, Rage Against the Machine, Public Enemy, continued that legacy of music reinforcing my political ideas. And so I want to say, like, when I finally expanded, I feel pretty confident saying that, when I finally expanded into my own kind of political language or things that motivated me and things that probably changed, definitely changed me probably for the rest of my life, it was when I took a political stance in response to sweatshops. In the 90s, there was a student-led, anti-sweatshop movement. And I think, in part because it was student-led, like, I was only 15, and the kids weren't that old, much older than me that were the face of this. But also, it just was really intriguing to me because it was my entry point into really looking at, I guess, supply chains and distribution and capitalism in a way. My parents never talked about that. Like, so this was my own sort of moment. And a journalist at the time, they were writing about this, there were all these exposés, and there was a broader conversation happening where companies based in America or Europe were taking advantage of loose labor laws or no labor laws in other countries and exploiting workers in ways they could never get away with doing in our country or in European countries, and including things like child labor. And so I think around that time, you know, when someone finally takes the veil off, you're like heartbroken and like, oh, the world's not perfect. And that was my moment, because it wasn't, oh, the world's not perfect, people are racist. I knew that because that's the way I grew up. It was, I can't even support half of the companies in my closet anymore. And like this realization of like how systemic and broad some of the problems of our time are, and how intricately intertwined so many different elements of our society are with these big problems. So, for example, I remember kind of going down the rabbit hole to try to find companies that had ethical practices, and it was like, I can only wear three companies for the rest of my life. And it was like, oh my goodness, right? Like, so, and I think, obviously that's not sustainable, right? But it was where I was at the time, and what the legacy of that has been for me and how I live my life is that I really have never gone back to thinking of individual incidences of injustice. That was my introduction into thinking about broad systems, and really understanding what's global about a problem that might seem like something in your neighborhood. So yeah, that transformed me, and that was my first, like, those were the first protests I went to. Those were my first experiences in boycotting something intentionally. I'm sure I boycotted things just being in my family as a child. I didn't know I was boycotting. But, like, you know, real dairy. That's another thing. My parents also didn't let us know how healthy we were. They just called it mayonnaise. They just called it milk. They just called it ice cream. We did not know that we were eating granola. They were just really, I think that it was so smart because we weren't resisting anything. Like, right? Like, we weren't protesting it because they didn't make it a big deal. Anyway, so that was my entry point, like sweatshops and really kind of thinking about what a giant monster injustice can be.
Absolutely. If I could have sent a little part that go up when you said the intricacies of the system, I would have. So I'm parting that verbally. For everybody who has joined us in the middle, I'm T.K. Smith, and I'm speaking with Lauren Tate Baeza on the occasion of an AP Business, where we're talking about our contributions to the spring issue of our paper. So you got another one for me?
Yeah, and I think we're having so much fun that I'm not going to get through all the questions I want. So now I have to figure out which one I want to ask you. Hold on. Okay, so I had like five, and I've already asked you two. Okay, I want to ask you this one. So you talk about how Confederate monuments represent the fragility of Black citizenship in your piece, and you liken them to the spectacle of lynching. You state that both are sites of pain and white celebration, picnics and fireworks. When I read that, I immediately thought about Stone Mountain Park. I want you to speak a little bit to the concept of monuments to Black pain. You thoughtfully discuss memorials like the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which is sometimes referred to as the Lynching Memorial in Montgomery, and other sites that depict Black people through the lens of unrealized citizenship. And you address, correctly in my opinion, that this narrative of Black suffering, you cite Stephen Kara Walker's work, which you talk about, Emmett Till's lynching photograph, his funeral photograph, rather, and how widely distributed that was. You talk about these depictions of Black suffering as depictions that are staples in the American visual culture that can desensitize people to Black pain at worst, and reinforce pain as the primary or full extent of our story at best, which I thought, again, was really thoughtful. That if people are so used to the story of Black America being the story of pain, we ought to think about that when we're building monuments and making art. So there's an absence that you point out, essentially, an absence in triumphant depictions, depictions that neither acquiesce to state power nor visualize Black pain. Do you think monuments of Black pain or that celebrate proponents of Black oppression should all be removed and replaced? Should they remain and be in dialogue with newer, empowered, and celebratory representations of Black life and Black heroes, even nameless ones, like Kende's piece, there's no one in particular that it's honoring, right? Or Simone Lee's Brick House isn't a specific tribute to a singular person. So representations of heroes were an abstraction. Or should they simply be removed and not replaced? What are your thoughts on that? So my choices were remove them and replace them, leave them and have more monuments that are in dialogue with them that do have these triumphant depictions, or just remove them. What do you think would be sort of the best way to go forward in terms of monuments in this country and abroad?
To take a cheap answer, I would say that the definitive answer lies in the hands of the community in which these monuments exist. What I would say to complicate my own answer is that it's not so much about one monument depicting pain or one monument depicting this particular point in history. I think it's more so about telling the truth and being responsive and showing the humanity of Americans, all Americans, and allowing Black Americans to be more than just the chattel slavery legacy. In the United States, we are so much more of a dynamic people than just one narrative that they love to place us in, as if all we've contributed to this country is getting you to see how inhumane chattel slavery is, or how inhumane segregation was or is, depending on who you ask and where you are in the United States. But now that we're living and existing in a time with so much technology, I feel like we're breaking down the misconception of monuments as being eternal and permanent. There's no more permanence because we saw somebody walk on up there and decapitate a monument. We saw a Black woman shimmy up a pole and pull down the Confederate flag. There's no more permanence to anything. Things can change. Kehinde Wiley's monument moved from Times Square to Virginia. That's astounding symbolically. I think that's astounding. And I think it speaks to the future of what I would like to see for art in the public sphere is monuments that have the ability to and the social approval to change and shift and be in conversation with, because that's where we'll get closer to our subjective truths. You know, it's so easy and usually one of the main weapons of white supremacy to say there is one narrative, and this is the narrative we're all going to support, regardless of who it maims and kills, right? What if we had multiple narratives in public space? What if we opened up public space to debate and conversation? You know, I think it's much more valuable to recognize how the people in a space shift and change. And how, you know, my historical Black community doesn't necessarily want this Confederate monument anymore. Or how this now new gentrified white community doesn't recognize the Black monument that should be there because there were once Black people here. You know, I think they can all exist and all be acknowledged. We can acknowledge all of those histories, and there doesn't need to be one that is higher or more supreme than another based on who has the means to build it and the government support to place it. If you see an empty plinth, you can fill it with something, even if it's just yourself. You know, you can put something in there, even if it's a can of Fanta soda. Like, I don't care. Be a part of the conversation is what's most valuable to me.
Thank you. I love your note on. I'm kind of in love with the temporary, like that we have perhaps. Perhaps what's most important is that we respond to the moment. And if the community changes what it wants, it changes what it wants, and it's okay, right? I kind of love that.
Yeah, and it's exciting. You know, we have enough technology to say, like, well, in 1990, people were really thinking about this. That's how scholarship, that's academia, you know. it's a mess that you have to wait till you get into a graduate program to start understanding that everything is constantly being combated, constantly, you know, the history of this or the truth of this or the theory of this constantly being combated. So why can't that be the truth on the street? You know, who is served most by permanence? You know, we are not, as beings, we're not permanent. So why does our built environment have to be? The natural environment isn't permanent. So getting to your question, at the National Center for Human and Civil Rights, you wear a lot of hats, you know, you wear a lot of hats and you represent a lot for that institution. Can you tell me how you mobilize that institution to blend curation and social justice? And can you tell me how you've created initiatives there that have expanded beyond the institution and how your work is continuing outside of the center as well?
Yes. Thank you for teeing me up for the plug. at the center, I mean, it's a center that tells this beautiful story about the American Civil Rights Movement. And it couches it in this window of 1954 through 1968, and really tries to make that meaningful globally by putting it next to our kind of leading, you have to go through it to kind of be led into an exhibition about the global human rights issues of our time, which is just a survey of some key human rights problems and heroes who have worked to solve those problems, address those problems all over the world. And so we are already positioned to be a dialogue by what we are about civil and human rights issues. We have advocacy arms, always have. And so the museum part is just half of what we do. Since we've had to close down during the pandemic, we've launched into advocacy full time. The building is no longer an option or a place for me to tell stories. In that position, I was definitely not just the caretaker of the two permanent exhibitions, but was the person who organized temporary exhibitions and am still whenever we reopen, that enhanced those permanent exhibitions. So little small exhibitions with the small amount of square footage I had to work with, and then most recently reactivating the plaza outside so that we aren't as limited by the square footage of the building. I was really happy to join the new campaign that we launched as a part of a response to inequities laid bare by COVID and also as a response to being closed. I'm almost evangelical in my belief in artists and their ability to help us navigate and solve problems. And so I wasn't satisfied with just sort of being another person helping on the team, helping to run this broader campaign, which is designed to produce some really thoughtful webinars and also perhaps more importantly, engage people to participate in their local government. Give them tools for how they can be more active participants in democracy. It's great. I wasn't satisfied with that being all I contributed. I always feel like the way that I can most add value is to sort of bridge this gap between social action and the creative world. And so I created this with some really great partners, little social media activation initiative that was designed to sort of community curate some selections of powerful works of art that really have helped us manage these really big problems. As I said, like thinking about systems and how to address problems that sometimes just feel way outside of our grasp. And so I just think that artists, they really help us with that. They nail it. And so do a lot of people, and they've been sharing their work. This sort of branch of our larger campaign is called Art for Equal Dignity. And so people are invited to share works of art, credit the artists, celebrate the artists with us, That's what we're all here to do. If you are an artist, feel free to share your own work and how it's in conversation with some of these civil and human rights issues of our time. And use the hashtag. So when you search that hashtag, you end up having this beautiful wall of political artwork. What's been really beautiful about the campaign that I didn't intend has been the captions. And people have really taken time to write really thoughtful captions. And I've gotten text messages and phone calls from people thanking me for inviting them to participate and giving them an excuse to reflect that in these times, a lot of people have been just sort of burdened with what to do. They want to do something, and no one's asking them how they feel. And this exercise has been an opportunity to express how they feel through their own artwork or through others, and to have a space in this caption to really articulate where they are, which is really important work, especially when it comes to the do. Because if you haven't properly reflected on the moment, your do isn't going to be as impactful or effective. So that's been the campaign that we're doing right now, where I'm trying to continue, as I always have in the physical building, to bring in the voice of artists. There was a series that I started a couple years ago when I first began working at the center, of conversations where we invited artists to talk about some of the problems of our time for the same reason. So it's an ongoing thing for me. It's a personal initiative for me to invite them to the same tables that politicians, human rights attorneys, pundits get invited to over and over and over again, because we have something so invaluable to offer. And so that's what I've been doing as an extension of this broader campaign for equal dignity that is actually like working on policy issues. I've created this art activation to help engage a community around this and to hopefully bring people over to the main campaign.
I've had the privilege of participating in myself. And I think it was a wonderful, it was a good experience for me. One, to curate something because everything is closed, and to think critically about the platform you've created for me to be able to say something. You know, I have so many things I want to say. Like, I'm just sitting in the house, like, bubbling with all of these things that I'm reading and wanting to interact with people and how I'm feeling and how I'm feeling about the more national, global conversations we're having, social conversations, environmental conversations. And it was just a beautiful way for me to be able to reach out to people I know and people I don't know. And I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the campaign. So thank you so much for creating that. And we have about 8 minutes left, y'all. So if anybody has any questions, now's the time to send it to us. Obviously, we like to talk, so please don't be shy. And you can find me, TK Smith, and Lauren Tate Baeza on Instagram, should you need to find us for further questions. But until we get some questions, you want to continue?
Yeah, and I just want to make sure, in case I didn't while I was talking about this, everyone who's watching, please participate. You're sharing artwork of, again, your own or your favorite artists or artists that have moved you and really helped you make sense of some of these tough issues. Big them up, celebrate them. They're every bit as important as people who are perhaps more immediately identified as activists and politicians. Do use the hashtag Art for Equal Dignity, tag the Center for Civil and Human Rights. I just wanted to say that, like, I really want, it's not like only certain people can do it. Everyone's invited. The whole point of this was so that it could be completely democratic and everyone's sort of voice is important, because what's meaningful is the chorus that's created. You got a question, TK?
Oh, okay. Oh, and it's for me. Could you talk more about the specific process you were able to follow to get context added to a structure and fourth part? Sorry if my memory of the details fails me. It was part of a class. Could I talk more about the specific process I was able to follow to get context added to the structure and fourth part? there was a Confederate memorial that I did my master's thesis on in Forest Park that has now since been removed shortly after the election of Mayor Lyda Crewson. I wasn't able to actually get context added. I was part of the debate of what we should do with the Confederate memorial. And my suggestion was that we contextualize it fully, which would be an economic investment in a restructuring of that entire space. But it ended up being removed. So that conversation kind of ended for me. I don't know if that answers your questions, but please DM me if you need more specific details. Because I'm here.
Can I ask you one more question, TK?
Yeah.
How much time do we have?
5 minutes.
Okay. So I guess we have to both be brief here. At the end of your piece, you talk about a man who was shot outside your doorstep. And this is deeply personal. So thank you so much for sharing it. So we can all experience the meaning that you got from it. And again, you use this beautiful language. You describe him as squirming around the bullet that had pierced him. You stay with him until the police and paramedics come because you did not want him, as you said, to die alone. As you tell the story, you freeze time. And again, you discuss bodies, the politics of bodies. And you talk about everyone's body in the scene, with your body, the shot man's body, and the police officer's body represented in that moment. So whatever time allows, I'd love for you to talk about how that experience impacted you personally, and then how it is of service, this experience, how it's in service to your greater research on monuments.
I'm going to try to answer your question and a question in the comments at the same time. So to contextualize this piece, it is a trauma response to what has been happening to my people in this nation. The italicized portions of it are personal experiences that I needed to process and go through over and over and over again, because when a narrative starts screaming in your head, it has to come out in some way. You have to work it out in some way. And I'm thankful that my editor was willing to go through that with me. I needed those portions to be able to articulate to my audience, and my audience was marginalized people in the United States, particularly people of color, particularly Black and queer people. Like, your body has so much power. Should you use it? You know, your body can do so much. Should you extend it? You know, how you conceive of it. Our bodies in that moment were all communicating different things. This dying man who I didn't have a choice but to watch die. You know, it was hurtful, and that police officer who wasn't a Black man in that moment, you know, he wasn't a Black man watching another Black man die. He was an extension of the state. He was a police officer. And when that woman and I refused to leave that man who was dying, he reached for his gun. We were a threat to whatever process he had going on, whatever his politics are, whatever his orders were. We were all making choices in that moment. And regardless of what our choices were or how much power we had or how much we could actually do to comfort this man, that man died. And yeah, I'll tell you, I regret every time I've called the police ever in my life. To sum that up. Anywho, to answer the comment in the comments, I think that the ephemeral remains of things are very important, because just in the same way that we preserve monuments, there are lots of monuments in the country that we have let fall into disrepair. There are lots of buildings and neighborhoods and communities and institutions that have fallen into disrepair and have lack of political or economic support because there's political agendas, there's forces, there's reasons for that. And they communicate just as loudly as those we preserve. You know, if Stone Mountain fell into disrepair, a big chunk of it fell off and nobody fixed it, what does that communicate to the people around it? To the majority Black and brown and immigrant people in Stone Mountain, what does that say to them? that this institution is crumbling. It's almost literal, you know. When you go into a dilapidated neighborhood and you see houses falling apart, what is that city saying to the people who live in that neighborhood? We don't value you. We don't care for you. So I think rubble is important. It's important to read. I think graffiti is important to read. Graffiti artists are essential to community work. Yeah, I hope that answers both. We have 1 minute left. We have 27 seconds left. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Lauren Tate Baeza. Thank you, Art Papers. This was Art Papers Presents. Look out for the summer issue of Art Papers, Living and Working. That'll be coming out very, very soon. And then there'll be more Art Papers Presents for y'all to join contributors and conversation. So thank you all so much, and take good care of yourselves.
Thank you.
Thank you.